Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards and Robert Bound.
Today we meet the French-Moroccan film director Robin Campillo, whose film 120 Beats Per Minute is a pulse-quickening account of the story of activists combating misconceptions about AIDS in early 90s Paris.
We'll also be celebrating the Italian way of life with a recent convert, Iranian author and journalist Kamin Mohammadi. She'll be discussing her book, Bella Figura, a little later on.
I will be joined by the designer and infographic specialist Nigel Holmes. His new book, Crazy Competitions, depicts some of the world's most unusual competitive events, and its author has created many design firsts himself.
That's all on the way. Plus, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be bringing us some news stories to look out for, and Rob will play some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. We're in Studio One. Of course, it's Easter Sunday.
Yes.
What do you normally do to mark Easter Sunday? I can imagine you taking part in one of those very sort of moving, I don't know, religious rituals.
Yeah.
Sackcloth and ashes, that kind of thing that goes on?
Yeah, the Bounds would be taking part in that. What about the Edwards household? Is that pagan as hell?
It's generally fairly pagan.
Yeah.
And getting more so with each passing day.
Okay.
We're in the midst of... can we talk about this? We're doing some toilet training at the moment, Rob. And
okay.
That's not the royal we. I'm not talking about myself.
No.
Okay. I've been house trained for over a decade now.
Over a decade, yeah.
But yeah, that's going on. Best not to talk about that, especially on this religious day.
Okay. Is this an Easter tradition? Is there something specific
to Easter? It's an Easter tradition now. I don't know, penance, suffering.
It seems
to fit in broadly.
Walking around, it's the equivalent of kind of wearing the hair shirt.
40 days in the wilderness.
Do you know what? I think maybe it's time to get out. So someone knows what's happening next week. Someone's got some class in this studio. And it's only Fernando Augusto Pacheco. There was something in the air that night. The stars were bright, Fernando. They were shining there for you and me, for liberty, Fernando. Fernando Augusto Pacheco is here. Happy Easter Sunday to
Happy
you, Fernando.
Easter. Happy Easter to both of you.
How do we say it in Portuguese?
Feliz Páscoa.
Feliz Páscoa. Buona Páscoa.
I'm a big fan of Páscoa because of the chocolate. You know, I'm a big fan. And
yeah.
People say, oh, it's becoming commercial chocolate. I mean, getting more commercial. I love it. You know, it's
the spirit of the season.
Yes.
Exactly.
Sorry to be so blunt.
It's pretty good stuff.
And my grandma used to do a lovely cod as well. I think a lot of Brazilians eat
yes.
that during Easter. So
nice.
I have a kind of a serious story to start, but, you know, there's an election in Costa Rica today,
okay.
And it's very unusual to have an election during a holiday, because clearly it's also a holiday in Costa Rica, and there's an interesting battle there. Both of the first guy and the second guy, they both have a surname called Alvarado, so that's an interesting one. They're both former singers. The only difference is that...
Wow.
Yes.
Costa Rica is an unusual political climate.
Exactly. The favorite to win, it's Fabricio Alvarado, he's 43, and he's kind of evangelical, so he, you know, he's a former Christian, and he's also anti-gay marriage. And in the end, gay marriage became a very hot issue in Costa Rica, because an international court based in Costa Rica said that the Central American country had to legalize gay marriage, and he was very much against it. So I think he got all the votes, you know, especially from people from, you know, smaller towns. You know, they're very Christian there in Costa Rica.
Mm.
But the other guy, I think he's a bit cooler, in my opinion, but I think he might lose.
Which Alvarado is he?
It's Carlos Alvarado.
Carlos,
and he's a
classic.
Former rock singer.
Is he?
You know? Yeah. So
does he favour the leather trouser for the baby kissing photograph?
I wish. I think, you know, maybe he would be the favourite if he wears some leather trousers. But, you know, and of course he's pro-gay marriage, but I think you know, from what I can see in the latest polls, I think Fabricio Alvarado, unfortunately, is going to win. And it's interesting because, you know, Costa Rica is one of the most peaceful countries in the region. You know, you have terrible violence in Honduras, El Salvador, but I think Costa Rica is kind of a, you know, a haven in that region. Of course, they have their own problems. You know, unemployment, I think, is getting higher. But, you know, it's a fairly peaceful, but it's an interesting election.
What's next? Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
There's a new TV magazine coming up on Thursday called Pilot TV. They're from the same team behind Empire. And the reason why I chose the story is that I think this just shows how TV is becoming so important, because I think the editor, Terry White, you know, which I spoke to her on the stack about Empire magazine, because she said, you know, TV is becoming so cinematic these days that I think it was an idea that was about to happen, a magazine dedicated to all those shows. And I very much, you know, I love magazines. I very much look forward to buy the title. And I think that's kind of the trend, because even normal film magazines, they're also covering TV in a way they didn't even 10 years ago. Yeah.
Well, it's really interesting, Robert. I was going to ask you about this because you must have seen this. There's a feeling that if you want to do something really epic, huge in scope, as an actor, certainly as a writer, and without question as a director, you can actually find a better platform for something where you really let your dream come to fruition over, 10 hours on a Netflix, rather than you would over 90 minutes from a thing that's controlled by the Hollywood studios. I mean, presumably that's a conversation you have quite often with people, I guess.
Well, the magazine, we kind of tracked this fairly early on, kind of, we first of all, being quite traditionalist in the way that, you know, we kind of regard the platforms, you know, the kind of like Voice of God kind of broadcasters and what we now kind of weirdly call the heritage networks, the BBC, the ABCs, the CBSs of this world and all the rest of it. But then when you see the quality, then that's absolutely fine. It's a strange thing. You sort of have to make the choice if you're a director and a producer of making something that sits on the silver screen and is of that scale, that physical scale, where you're sitting in front of it and you can't help but be enveloped by it and it's by its soundtrack and all the rest of it. And you're seeing those famous faces, you know, high up and large, and that has a certain power which I'd never think you can recreate on the small screen. But then you have the intricacy and the power of that plotting and the investment as an audience member in this TV. So it's a really interesting moment. I'm really glad to see that. I'm sure this will have an all singing dancing website and apps and all the rest of it, and wonderful social media feeds and all the rest of it. But the fact that it's a decent looking, hopefully it'll be a nice fat issue for their first issue, this new magazine called Pilot. Best of luck to them.
The first cover is Luke Cage, which I haven't seen it. Have you guys seen it?
No, I haven't actually. No, I've seen that still from whizzing around the internet for yonks. But yeah, I think it's high time that this kind of thing happened. I really hope that, I hope they make a good stab at it.
Good luck to them.
Well, and we have a very fun one to end. I say fun one, not for the runners actually, but for us. It's Marathon de Sable. It happens every year in Morocco. It starts on the 6th of April. I think it's the hardest foot race in the world. I mean, apparently the runners or people who decide to go there, they have to walk for 250 kilometers in the Sahara Desert. So it's not an easy one, and it attracts quite a lot of people. I think even the Moroccan Ministry of Tourism is involved. You know, I think they have about 1,300 runners, and only about 30 of them are from Morocco. So all the rest are very much international. I wouldn't do it.
I've got a friend who's done this.
But one of the things that you have to contend with, of course, you imagine, incredibly arid, incredible heat. It's the sand. You know, it gets everywhere.
Yeah.
And you have to wear these sort of gaiter things, I'm not sure what they are, and you have to tape up your shoes because if you get sand in your feet. But they're knocking out maybe 50 miles some days.
Yeah.
In the Sahara Desert. Is that sensible?
It doesn't bear thinking about.
Do they have to walk with antivenom, I wonder? I try to find out because, you know, there are snakes in Sahara Desert.
I expect they run away with the pounding of the shoes.
There's lots of medics knocking around. And you keep saying walking fair. These guys are running.
They're running.
The guy who wins, the times are staggering. He's running each marathon distance way faster than your kind of club runner would do even on a city foot race. It's absolutely staggering.
Are they proper sort of run? Are they sort of world championship? Are they distance runners of name and repute? Or are they just, is it kind of a bit of a Ironman
type
thing?
I think they're ultra runners. Is that what they're called?
Yeah. For example, there's for them in the Mayo competition, I think there's a Moroccan runner called Rashid El Morality. He won for the last 5 years. That's impressive. I wonder if he's going to win again. I think in the women's one, there's been more changes. The last one was Elizabeth Burns from Sweden.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco, possibly see you at the same time next week.
Feliz Pascua.
Filmmaker Robin Campillo's screenwriting and editing credits include masterpieces such as The Class, which swept Cannes and elsewhere in 2008. He's back now as director of 120 Beats Per Minute, a film telling the story of the ACT UP movement in France.
The activist group raised awareness and challenged discrimination against those diagnosed with AIDS and HIV in the late 80s and early 90s. Robin was involved with the movement himself and earlier joined Rob to discuss a deeply personal film.
Ensemble, nous pouvons unir nos forces pour résister à l'épidémie et aux problèmes sociaux qu'elle engendre.
Il faut inverser le rapport de force. C'est pas nous qui avons besoin des labos, c'est eux qui ont besoin de nous.
Tu vois bien qu'on n'arrive pas à mobiliser les médias sur la question des traitements.
I try to think about a film about the AIDS epidemic from the very beginning of the epidemic in 82. The first time I read an article in the French newspapers that was called the gay cancer, because we were not talking about AIDS at the moment. It was like in 82, and I was 20 years old. And as a young gay guy, I was so afraid of this kind of thing that will happen. And, you know, in the French newspaper, people were saying that most gay men were going to die of this disease, even if it was not absolutely true. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, during 10 years in France, so you had these articles which were very hard on the gay community and other communities.
There's a lot of judgment straight away. Yeah.
But at the same time, there were no communications towards us about the epidemic. So we were like invisible, and we were going to die invisible in our closets. And so the 80s has been like a nightmare too, because I was remote from my own youth, from my own life, because I didn't have relationship with guy for many, many years because I was so afraid of that. So, and at the same time, I've been to cinema school, and I kind of lost the interest in cinema because I was so obsessed by this epidemic that I couldn't project myself in a film, you know. And in 92, so after 10 years of epidemic, I got into this group, Actor Paris, and I kind of reinvented myself in this group, because, you know, we were talking about politics, but we were kind of creative at the same time. We were talking about making new actions, new posters, new slogans, and there were kind of jubilation and energy and fun in this group that helped me to get back into my own life, you know. And so it's because I'm very slow and lazy, it took me like ages before I understand that I should do a film about this moment where we stopped being the poor gay guys victim of the epidemic, and we decided to become like more the evil fags and dykes, you know. we wanted to change the perception of this epidemic, and especially to make this epidemic a political subject. I mean, at the time, I was really angry. I'm not that angry today. There's a difference in politics between, I think, causes and struggles. Causes, it's you're struggling for something which is not yourself, you know, and you don't incarnate the political debate, you know. In the case of AIDS and HIV contamination, it's your body. You embody the struggle, and that's a struggle. It's like, for me, like the women with abortion. You know, it was really related to their body, to their bodies. And so that's the kind of anger which is so inside yourself that you are kind of burning with that, and you need to express yourself. But you cannot invent that. You cannot invent anger.
And we should refer to the title, 120 beats per minute, is the optimum beat for music, because it mimics the heartbeat of the human body. And so you have these two mixtures in your film. You have the euphoria of clubbing and guys meeting guys. Mm. And then you have the sort of exposition, and you have the politics and all the rest of it. How did you strike that balance? Was that something plotted out and scripted out? Was that something you workshopped? Or was that just a feeling you had that there had to be a nice mixture of euphoria and politics and seriousness, I suppose?
You know, when you're working, I really hope sometimes I'm a very lyrical director. I love cinema, which is a little bit too much in the kind of romantic, I mean like a German romantic from the 19th century. I love to imagine that I make films like this.
There's something operatic to it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, for instance, I knew that you had this, the protagonists were like soloists, and the rest of the amphitheater was like a choir, you know, and I love this operatic level. And, you know, I don't like in cinema the fact that you have to choose one level of fiction, you know. So, or you are realistic or naturalist, or you are, you know, in a kind of, yes, lyric atmosphere, or you are in, and I like the idea that in a film you can go from one atmosphere in the same scene to another atmosphere, like there is a metamorphosis or mutation. And for me, that's the main important thing to say, because of course when I think of this period, I have a lot of impressions, of sensations, and feelings of sensualities. And I wanted to show that I was going from one to another, you know, and I didn't know how, you know. And so it was scripted mostly. But, you know, even if you plan all those things, the main thing for me in the when you are doing a film is the actors and the locations. You know, that's the main thing. And my actors, you know, after a moment when I find my actors, I totally forget the characters in the script because that's not very interesting. And if you want to have three-dimensional characters, you have to look at your actors and to work with them, to talk with them, because, of course, most of them are young gay people and they don't have the same perception of the epidemic that
I
have.
Yeah, so what was that like? So did you have to sort of sit people down and explain this? Or I mean, obviously, actors read around the subject a lot, go very deep into characters, you'd hope so. Did you have to kind of give them a lesson? How did that work?
Yes, a little bit, because, you know, in fact, I didn't know that they didn't know. Mm. And they didn't know so much things, and especially about ACT UP, but about the epidemic, in fact. Of course, they know the disease, and they are still very afraid of it. It's not true that they don't care. It's not true. And even that when they take risks, it doesn't mean that they don't care. It means that sometimes they are really afraid, but they are sometimes in a denial. But, of course, you know, when we did a few rehearsals for 3 days of all the debates in the amphitheater, and that was amazing to see them doing that, you know, but I realized that sometimes they didn't understand what they were talking to, what they were talking about. So after a moment, we decided, I have a guy who was working a little bit with me on the script, Philippe Mangeau, who was a member and has been president of ACT UP. So he told all the assembly, he made a course about the time, and there was two books which were very important for them. There was a book by Didier Lestrade, who was a founder of ACT UP Paris, and it's an history of ACT UP and a very personal history of ACT UP. But you can, in his style, you can hear the way we were talking at the time, and that was really important also for them. And so they read this book, and also in 1993, we wrote a book in ACT UP about all our struggles and all our with all our the issues we were into. So they had this book to read, and that was very helpful for them. But you know, when I did the casting, I was really searching for. I wanted to hear the music of the voices 25 years ago. So it was mainly the most important thing to me, to have the attitude of the, you know, the self-irony we could have, and the fact that sometimes we were overplaying also anger, you know, and that doesn't mean we were not sincere, but it's something to do with politics and the fact that it was like there was a kind of theatrical dimension in this group, especially during the amphitheater debates. And I wanted to be honest about that and to show that in the film. It was hard because we were losing very young friends and lovers, but because we were young, we were able to go further. But that's a very strong thing. You know, I realized that doing this film, and maybe it took me so much time to make this film because I was so afraid to connect myself to these emotions and to this sensation. And I'm not sure I would do all I did, you know, 25 years ago, at my age, I wouldn't be able. For instance, I remember there's a scene in the film that I lived, you know, I dressed up a friend of mine with his mother, and the mother was talking to his child as if he was alive. You know, at the time, of course it was hard, but I was quite so surprised by the reaction of the mother that I was quite laughing doing it. But I wouldn't now, you know, but I think at the time we were kind of trying not to be overwhelmed by our emotions. I think it was something that was crucial for us to survive.
Robin Campillo there discussing 120 beats per minute with Rob a little earlier. You're with the Monocle Weekly.
Let's have some new music now. Snail Mail is the name of a young Baltimore talent called Lindsay Jordan, and this is her new one. It's called Pristine.
That was Snail Mail, aka Lindsay Jordan, with Pristine there. You're with the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. The pleasures of the Italian lifestyle are well known, but that doesn't stop new adoptees discovering sun-kissed coastal living, centuries of culture and, of course, the food all over again.
Carmine Mohammadi is a British Iranian writer who's graced the Monocle Weekly airways in the past, and she joins us again this week to discuss her new book, Bella Figuera, How to Live, Love and Eat the Italian Way. Welcome back, Carmine.
Hello.
Lovely to have you. Congratulations. You've got a fresh stack. I expect the crack of the spine and the smell of the print is a delicious thing to behold.
Yes.
We'll get into that in a minute. Congratulations on the new book. Tell us how you ended up in, well, Florence, first of all. Tell us how you ended up there.
Well, I ended up there by accident, which you would have thought would be quite hard to do,
yeah.
To move countries
EasyJet's
by accident.
EasyJet's crap, isn't it? Only joking, EasyJet.
yes, quite.
So you literally didn't end up there by accident, but it was an unforeseen adventure.
It really was. Okay. I went to, and this is what this book recounts, so some time ago I had a commission for my last book, The Cypress Tree, and I was struggling to find space to write it in London, and I had, you know, my regular life was extraordinarily stressful at work, you know, the kind of thing. And I met a wonderful woman called Christabel Kent, who's a writer as well. And she said to me, just as you do, she said, oh, I've got a flat in Florence. Why don't you go there? Take some time off. Don't do anything. You don't have to pay me rent. Go there and write your book. And I went.
Have you got her email address?
I've told you her name. You can look her up.
Yep.
So she was extraordinary. She literally changed my life. So I was made redundant. I lost my flat. It was all a series of quite weird coincidences. So I suddenly thought, oh, look, I have no life. I might as well go there. The idea was to stay for 6 weeks. So that was 10 years ago. So I think Christabel would quite like her flat back.
Christabel, very good name for a fairy godmother. This must be a gift for an editor, this kind of thing. At what point did it seem like this would make a good book?
I decided to stay. And really, it was only many years later, after all the extraordinary things that happened to me, particularly in that first year, particularly in the first few months, and just how sort of transformative it was. You know, I would come back to London and people would go, and they wouldn't recognise me. And I mean, I was a bit nonplussed actually by that. Was I looking so awful before? But apparently I was, or apparently I just changed a lot. And I think that it was a lot to do with, well, I mean, it was to do with being happy, obviously, but it was to do with Florence is so beautiful. I mean, you know, try to find an ugly bit of Florence. But it was just that beauty at every level. It was the light. It was the buildings. It was the lifestyle. It was the people. And I wrote more words in those first 6 weeks than I had in 2 years in London. So it obviously had an extraordinary effect on my creativity, I suppose, which is not surprising when you think that, you know, all the artists, all the art, all the things that Florence has invented actually over the years. But there's probably a reason, right? There's some special...
Something in the water.
Well, it's designed, a city designed for Renaissance. And I guess that's what you enjoyed of your own. But tell me a bit about that, because there's plenty of examples of great writers going to countries, buying into cultural phenomenon and trying to soak up almost by osmosis some of that local magic. And there's lots of examples where that doesn't work out. Why is it so accessible though? Because it seems you clicked in with everything. And obviously this book is a celebration of that whole holistic thing, the food, the lifestyle, everything. Why did it work? Were you predisposed to be Florentine, I guess?
It's a really interesting question. And you know what I realised? I'm from Iran, and everything about the lifestyle there in Florence was so reminiscent of my childhood in Iran. And that really intrigued me because I realised really quickly that Italy, it's in Europe, but it's not in Europe. It's not like Northern Europe.
It's not Northern Europe. There's such a big difference.
It's so different. Yeah. It's so different. And the Italians themselves, I mean, they say about Rome, they say that Rome is the northernmost African capital, you know.
And a lot of Northern Italians are deeply snobbish about that because
extremely,
of that fact, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Whereas, you know, I'd been to Italy once before and I went to Sicily and I went with my best friend who happens to be Italian. You know, we were friends in London. And we went to Sicily and she looked at me after 3 days when, you know, at first I'd been worried about driving and all the chaos. And after 3 days, I went to pick her up from something. And she came out and I'd parked diagonally half on a pavement and I'd been, you know, swearing at everyone and I was kind of
weaving. Made the mayor. I
and she looked at me and she went, oh, my God, yeah. You are from the south of Iran, aren't you? But, you know, all this British veneer that I had that she'd known just fell away. And it was like being home, you know, particularly in Sicily, particularly with that kind of chaos, the part of Iran that I'm from. So in Florence, it was a more gentle version of it. So just things like visiting the market and something really simple, like going to the market one day and everyone was excited because, you know, the first blood oranges are in. And it was like being back in Iran when, you know, it was the beginning of September and it was time for fresh pistachios. That rhythm of life, that sense of ritual, that simplicity. You know, I couldn't go to a supermarket and buy an avocado. I couldn't because they don't have avocados there. It was that reconnection with the land, with what's available, and just we're so close culturally. We discovered this before, you know, with my friend. We have lots of things in Iranian culture that are exactly the same in Italian culture that don't really exist to the same extent over here in the UK. So, you know, we have this really complicated system of courtesy, so do they. We have this very, a lot of respect, you know, for our elders, and that comes out in the language, you know. You, just how do I address you? Are you singular? Are you, you know.
You two or vous or whatever.
Two
yeah.
or vous. And they've have three. And, you know, I've, for example, I've never called my parents you other than the most respectful, the kind of plural. It was really interesting and it made me really examine my own relationship with my sort of cultural identity. And of course, I was there to write a book about Iran. So that's what I was going into anyway, to having to examine all of that.
And actually, just in terms of that, the temperature, the scents wafting up into your study window, all these sorts of things. I wonder whether it helps to be somewhere that reminds you of home, of Iran, of the book that you were writing back then, or whether it's better to be in a kind of cloistered, cold, floored London apartment or somewhere else. I wonder what is better for the imagination.
You know what? I wonder too. And I don't have an answer, but I do know that it certainly worked for me. And just aside from the absolute sensual pleasure of having, you know, the jasmine drifting up and just again, that sense of the seasons, you know, I arrived in January, so I watched all the seasons go by. And you know, in London, I had a lovely flat. I had a park outside my window, so I saw the seasons because of the trees. But this was just a much closer connection. And it did, you know, by the time that I was 8 or 9 months down the line and I was really stuck into the book, and Florence was, it was very hot, it was the summer and there weren't many people around. I literally was walking around and it was as if I could see, you know, Iran that I was writing about overlaid on, and they're very different, you know, in the sense that Iran doesn't look anything like Florence, but the little alleyways, the smell of the sewers, the inner courtyards of the houses, you know, the palazzos that sort of hug their privacy, that felt very familiar to me. Whereas I had British friends coming who would say, oh, I feel very weird about these big walls and the fact that there's no green and that you can't see into the gardens. I feel very excluded. And I thought, huh, I don't, because that's how we grew up. Of course, I understand that, you know, that you protect your family from the outside with the fortress-like walls of the palaces, and inside is where you have your courtyards. And I found so much, I mean, no one ever talks about this, but I found so much about the architecture that was extremely, to me, seemed very derivative from Islamic, you know, and Persian architecture. And no one was talking about it. I was following all the guidebooks around and they were going, you know, Etruscans and Romans and classicism, and that's why the Renaissance and, you know, this and that and Brunelleschi. But I went home and did some research, and that's really intriguing to me because I think there was probably a much greater flow of ideas between the East and West than we think so now.
And the way they're filtered, I suppose, that process in itself becomes interesting. And I guess you've done that yourself as a writer and as someone who's been living in these different cities. I did want to ask you a bit about food, partly because I feel slightly shortchanged. You know, describe blood orange season here, pistachio season here. I don't know what do we have?
I'm really hungry here.
Sprout season in the UK? It's
parsnips.
We've got rhubarb season.
Parsnips, I love.
We've got rhubarb season at the moment. Come
on. But food is really central here, to the extent that the book is, of course, punctuated with recipes, which is not necessarily what you might expect in a book of this character. Was that just because it's so central a theme? You know, the very granular approach to the food had to be part of the story.
I think that's absolutely right. I'll tell you a secret. Originally, I wanted to write a sort of lifestyle and diet guide book, let's say, because I felt that the Italian, not just the produce, and which is extraordinary, but the Italian way of eating and living had been so healing for me and my body. You know, I'd had this life where I had access to, well, you know, everybody, the hottest new nutritionist, the whatever, you know, the new exercise craze, the whatever diet. And I tried everything, but my health had gotten worse and worse, in fact, you know, in that typical way where doctors couldn't identify anything. So it was all about kind of, I don't know, allergies, intolerances, you know, wheat-free this, gluten-free that, blah-free that. And it didn't matter how sort of healthy my lifestyle was on paper in London. It wasn't until I got there and ate pasta and drank wine and ate gelato that I actually...
I've been doing it right all these years.
I suddenly feel a lot better,
See, that's
doctor.
The secret. I suddenly, you know, I lost all this weight that had piled on. My skin cleared up. All my digestive problems kind of ended. And and that's why I felt that it was really important to bring that in, because I think that we get trapped in this city life and we forget that there's something outside of it. And I really wanted to offer that. You know, I wrote this book for the girl or boy who's on the tube in the morning, you know, with their head stuck in someone's armpit and they just can't bear it. And this gives you a sort of an escape, but also hopefully a way to bring whatever you find charming, maybe in this book, also back home. So, you know, at the end of the chapter, if you fancy it, you can try out that recipe. You can try out some of the kind of tips, because obviously, in a way, it's easy to be happy when you're, you know, traveling in Italy because it's so beautiful. Everything is beautiful. The light, the architecture, the cities, the art, the food, the people, you know, all of it. It's like, go to Italy and be unhappy. Try. But how do you do that at home? You know, we can't all do what I did. We can't all have a lovely, sassy, punk fairy godmother like Christabel and manage to have a life where you can do that, drop everything and kind of go somewhere and have the flexibility to start a new thing. So it was really important to bring in those recipes, to give people the chance to bring that lifestyle home. I think that's really what it's about.
And just finally, how do you, this book, is one of its strengths is, I sense you, although you feel at home, you know you're not a local. And that's what you're kind of riffing on. You're riffing on noticing how beautiful things are, whereas other people might not. You never know what's beautiful on your own doorstep. Or if you're a local, you might hasten to say that the traffic's terrible or the sewers smell. Or
absolutely.
You even find a bit of romance in that, and I understand that completely. How much at arm's length do you have to keep the culture of Italy, of Florence, and how do you stop becoming a local? And are you kind of cognizant of that you want to kind of push it away slightly so that you can appreciate all its qualities?
So I've been there 10 years now. I do speak Italian and I do have Italian
gestures. Waving and shouting just started getting me, got on people's wick after a while.
But, you know, you have these conversations with other sort of Northern European friends in Italy. You know, my Dutch friend will come back and go, I was just in Amsterdam. I freaked out all my friends because I stood too close to them.
Yeah.
You know, and I spoke really loudly. So some of it you pick up because you can't help it. I guess for me personally, you know, I'm a transplanted person anyway. So I grew up in one country to 9 years old, and then I came here. And I think my comfortable position is always to be a little bit outside anyway.
So, well, it's good if you're a writer as well, right? You need that. It's difficult to do it well, always on completely home turf, I think.
Yes, you need to be able to notice things. You need to be able to remark on things and go, huh, that's different. But what's interesting about the position I'm in now, because, of course, I come back to, you know, I'm in between both countries, is that because of Italy, I notice more about here as well. So I'm comfortable enough there that I sort of know how things are done, but it's still noticeable. And I come back here and I go, huh, okay. Oh, guess, oh, look, British people don't all speak at the same time.
Yeah. There are small mercies about being British still, right?
Oh, my God, so polite. It's lovely. It's lovely. People stop and listen. I mean, they might not be listening, really, but at least they try.
Thank you so much, Camille. Congratulations on the book. It is Bella Figuera, How to Live, Love and Eat the Italian Way. Camille Mohammadi, thank you very much for joining us again.
Thank you very much for having me.
British-American graphic designer Nigel Holmes is known for infographics and turning complex ideas into enlightening and entertaining visuals. His talents have helped create imagery for brands ranging from Apple to National Geographic and Time magazine, where he was graphics director for over a decade.
He has a new book of fascinating infographics soon to be released this April from Tashin. It's called Crazy Competitions, 100 Weird and Wonderful Rituals from Around the World, and sheds light on some of the more unusual global contests to be found if you look closely. Enough. And he joins us from upstate New York now. Nigel, welcome to the programme and congratulations on this stunning and very amusing book. So let's sort of start at the top. Was there one sport that you'd seen yourself or you'd maybe taken part in being a Brit abroad that was the inspiration for this book?
Well, there wasn't one. And in the introduction that I have written, we actually make it clear that none of these are really sports. They are really crazy, a lot of them. The thing that really got me going was not in England, although England, we could have done a whole book about crazy stuff in England. But the thing that got me going was the Nathan's hot dog eating contest here in America, which is a truly disgusting event to watch. I went there, not this year, but last year. Believe it or not, they stuff 70 hot dogs, the winners, into their mouths in 10 minutes, and then they retire behind a wall.
Okay,
And you can imagine what happens. Yeah.
Is that the one at Coney Island?
Yes, it is, yes.
And in a weird way, those sorts of events, they somehow seem often fitting of their respective landscapes, whether it's Coney Island or whether it's some other sort of esoteric event happening halfway up a mountain somewhere. Did some of them, despite their strangeness, ever strike you as just the right thing to be doing in a given place?
Well, yes. I mean, there's the cheese rolling in England, which has this extraordinarily steep hill that they roll circular cheeses down, and it's completely kind of undefended by any kind of railings or anything, and spectators can get hurt by rolling cheeses, so much so that they have ambulances standing by, but they actually changed a couple of years ago, they changed the heavy cheese to a plastic one so that if it rolls off into the spectators, they don't even get bruised.
I thought you were going to say that they changed the heavy cheese for maybe a brie or something like that. Yes. But I guess that wouldn't work, would it?
No, I think that would be just as heavy, actually, the size that they are. It's quite a big thing.
That's rather sad, isn't it? It's nothing sacred.
Nigel, can I just ask you a bit about your process then as a graphic artist? Is it the case that sometimes you read about an event or see it or see footage and immediately in your mind it presents a way that it could live as a graphic representation of that? Or do you often have to kind of, I don't know, sketch lots of things out and give it lots of thought and look at things obliquely to work out how you will bring that to life on the printed page?
Both those things you said are right. Sometimes you get an image straight away. And when I started doing the book, it was actually my intention to do very simple graphic images. So it would be just one dead rat flying across the page or a series of green wellies just being thrown across the page, both of those, you know, the welly wanging is big in
yes.
in Upper Thong, Yorkshire. And so those images are very simple. I mean, the wellies are just five or six green wellies getting smaller because they're going off into the distance. And the rat is just one big rat. But But the more I did this, the more I thought there's much more interest in a lot of these things than I thought. And so some of them are truly kind of infographic in that they have a lot of detail in them. And some of them are very simple and simply graphic. Also, I had to somehow maintain a certain consistency. So there's a grid and there's a map on the left-hand side and little sidebars and so on. So that holds it all together. But actually, inside the book, some of the stuff is just freely drawn because I just wanted to amuse myself more. Also, there are some things that look better when they're drawn realistically as opposed to drawn like a infographic, like little stick men. So, you know, I try to kind of play with this and make it so that the reader gets some surprises as they're going along. Also, turn the book up on its end for kind of long things.
Can I just say, harking back to your sort of very august career, obviously doing this sort of, we might say, in inverted commas, for real, although working with Tashan on a book is obviously a great invitation and a great thing to do as well at the same time, Nigel. Is it kind of nice when you're dealing with, you know, the sort of GDP of France or whatever it might be for Time magazine or whatever it is, that suddenly working on something that is entirely light-hearted and with a sort of bit of a historiographical kind of background in it? Does this kind of set you free as a graphic designer? As you say, you had a sort of grid, you had a map and all the rest of it, but essentially you can kind of go for it as a designer.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. But, you know, apart from Time magazine, where I actually had a great time as well, and they were very good and allowed me to do things which Time would never do these days. Not that there is really a Time magazine now, actually, unfortunately. Mm. But I grew up in England with The Goons and with Beyond the Fringe and with Monty Python and people like that. And that humor actually goes well over here. So I'm hoping that the book will go down well here and elsewhere.
When I wonder, Nigel, do you think that you, when you draw, particularly freehand and so on, do you think you draw with an English, not accent, but I don't know, sensibility? Do you think that people who don't know you personally would say, aha, there's a British sensibility here?
Well, maybe. I mean, you know, the idea of drawing is something that I hold very dear, in fact. And when computers came along, I thought that the work that I did kind of went downhill a bit because I was trying to use the computer to draw the same way that I had drawn by hand, even though that was pretty mechanical as well. I mean, the stuff that I did at the Radio Times before coming to America was all drawn with rulers and, you know, French curves and so on, and ovals, so, and kind of perfect lines, which translated very well for Time magazine. But I always hankered after drawing with my own hand, and I still do that. I mean, I go out, not every day, certainly not in the winter, but in the summer, and I go down to a beach that's nearby here, and it's, you know, it's the beginning of the Atlantic Ocean, actually, and I just draw what's in front of me. So I've got tons of sketches and everything, which nobody will ever see or care about, and, you know, my son might keep them once I've shuffled off this earth and maybe put them in an album or something. But I think that there is something about drawing by hand that just can't be beaten by any form of electronic aid or device. It's just not the same. And certain things, like the drawing of the horses in the Siena race, I couldn't have got that kind of energy and life into a horse if I'd drawn it on a computer the way that I draw information graphics.
No, but some of those illustrations are beautiful. And you're absolutely right. I mean, there are obviously some things that are are meant to be funny, and a lot of them are. But there's some great beauty in that book as well. We shouldn't sell it short, Nigel. Congratulations on the book. Too bad we didn't, unfortunately, not necessarily on that same theme, get to Turkish oil wrestling. But maybe that'll we can reprise the chat at some other time. For the time being, Nigel Holmes, thank you very much for joining us. And the book is Crazy Competitions: 100 Weird and Wonderful Rituals from Around the World. And that is out later this April, published by Taschen. That was episode 456 of the Monocle Weekly.
Count them up, Rob. And what a delight. I feel we've had a, as usual, sort of global odyssey.
Yep.
We talked.
The gamut's been run.
Great design, stateside. The room positively had the fragrance of oranges and rose water, didn't it, when we were talking about La Bella Figura.
La Bella Figura. The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.